It is Monday, March 7th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Kimberly St. Julian Varnin, PhD student in history at the University of Pennsylvania on the Ukrainian history and the dynamic with Afro-Ukrainians in the country. Meanwhile, Russia claims to offer civilian evacuation routes to Russia and Belarus for what, the fourth time now, but continues to shell civilian areas. In Russia itself, over 4,500 were arrested yesterday for protesting against the Ukrainian invasion. U.S. and Europeans contemplate sending warplanes to Ukraine and banning Russian oil imports. Big deal. That's a big deal. WNBA star Brittany Griner detained in Russia for a vape pen. UK and France close to brokering a new Iranian nuke deal. The DC Court of Appeals quashes the Biden administration's use of Title 42 for families, at least. World COVID death toll tops 6 million as the pandemic enters its third year, at least specifically in this country. New York City lifts school mask mandates. The Biden Education Department forcing a bankrupt cancer patient to show hardship. The $100,000 they owe. Meanwhile, the administration floats the idea of extending the student debt moratorium. Supreme Court reinstates the death penalty for the Boston Marathon bomber. And a new report out of MIT's journal, law enforcement in Minnesota have been running a long-time spying program against BLM. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I'm getting a notice that the YouTube chat is disabled. People are freaking out about that.
What?
It's on now. Okay. Someone
got
freaked out by that, apparently.
I see it. Bradley's showing the evidence.
I'll tell you who's just about to get banned from the IMs, though, is MIDI Doctors.
Really?
They sent like 12 YouTube chat disabled buttons to me.
All right. Well, you know, the world keeps spinning on its axis, MIDI Doctors. Hello,
joining
Sam.
Me today,
Hi.
Emma Bigland. Hello, Emma.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing all right. How about yourself?
I am well. Let me just say happy birthday to my son, Saul.
Happy birthday, Saul.
Saul,
9 years old.
Is 9 years old today. Which is nuts. When my son was born, that is what gave birth to Mike and Matt Mondays on this program.
Oh, yeah.
Which was my attempt to get a parental leave for what turned out to be an extended period of time. and much to the benefit of everyone, though, I think. So that worked out well. We took Saul. Saul had a birthday party yesterday.
Rock climbing, you said?
Yes. And
again, that's the perfect activity for like kids that age. I remember loving those birthday parties.
Yeah, I was surprised. A little hectic, a little exhausting. And of course, it was my sister's birthday on Saturday.
Julie?
Yes.
Happy birthday, Julie.
So happy birthday to my sister as well. So I'm exhausted.
We're just throwing birthdays out there. Happy birthday to one of my closest friends, Christy. We did karaoke on Saturday. I won the shofar. Hey, you got two.
I mean, I don't think people have ever heard. Don't know who Christy is. I mean, they've heard of my sister and Saul before. So, sorry.
Yeah, but I mean, this is me like showing my dominance, right? Like,
Getting super weird around here on a Monday. I'm exhausted. Yeah.
You had an that lasted for 10 seconds.
Yeah, no, so. I had a brain freeze. All right, folks. So let's get into this. We pre-recorded the interview the other day, but really interesting stuff in terms of like a good history of Ukraine, but also addressing questions of the Azov battalion. Is that or regiment?
Battalion, right?
I mean, it depends on who you talk to. The presence of neo-Nazis in the context of the government. I mean, all the questions that you had or have about Ukraine, I think, answered in this interview and more, frankly. She is a historian who is also studying the dynamic of race in the context of Ukraine. Very interesting interview. But before we go there, the dynamic has not changed dramatically over the course of the weekend with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. They offered, I think it was essentially over the past 24 hours, a safe passage corridor to Belarus or Russia for civilians, as opposed to, say, out the West. And the Ukrainians more or less rejected it.
Understandably.
Well, the other dynamic is that the Russians have claimed to offer at least one or two other civilian sort of passageways that they then proceeded to bomb. And it is becoming clear that phase two, if phase one doesn't work for the Russians, is to punish the civilian population as much as they can. And with that said, there is still a growing choir of people in this country, perhaps in Europe, although I would imagine less so, who are determined to get the United States and Europe into the game more. And here is Joe Scarborough, former Republican congressman, came in during the Newt Gingrich revolution, pushing that very same thing.
Spoke yesterday to several senior administration officials in previous administrations, and I was struck by how many of them understood that the United States should not introduce troops to NATO, should not have a no-fly zone because of what that would provoke. But I did hear quiet criticism, something that they said they would not say publicly, but quiet criticism that the United States should not recoil every time Vladimir Putin or his foreign minister wave the bloody flag of basically nuclear brinkmanship. When we are silent, when we back down, when we capitulate to that, they suggest that we actually make it more likely that Putin sees us as weak and that he's more likely to use nuclear weapons. And their suggestion is to call his bluff and speak about the consequences of nuclear weapons and the consequences for the Russian people and to not just, again, be seen to be capitulating. I'm curious what you think.
What does that even mean, though? What is it that you're, how are you capitulating? If you're not going to, and he said that, and I would imagine he's talking about the George Bush administration. Right. I don't know how many Donald Trump administration folks would be talking to him, although I'm sure the same ones who were there during the Bush administration, of which there certainly were some. There were Republicans, after all. If they're saying at that point, well, yeah, you don't want to do the no-fly zone, and you don't want to do you don't want to have military personnel there. What is the capitulation that is going on here?
It's just we look weak. We look weak.
But how do you go? Well, if you bomb us, we'll bomb you. I mean, is that not really firmly? Does Putin really think, or is in any danger of thinking, maybe if I bomb them, they won't bomb me?
No. I mean, this has been relentless. I mentioned this before the show. CNN was on in like the laundry when I was doing my laundry in the room there. And it's just what are we going to do next? How are we going to act next? How are we going to respond? How is the United States going to show its strength in this area? And like, you have people like Marco Rubio, Boris Johnson saying, no, we don't want a no-fly zone, because there's an understanding of what that means. There, after the show ended, a poll came out, which was like poorly worded, but it still, I think, is instructive, because these things are not explained to the American public, definitely not on Fox News, on cable news. A no-fly zone is not a force field. 74% of Americans, according to this poll, said that they would support a no-fly zone. No. A no-fly zone would mean shooting down Russian planes. That would mean war. And that's not something that anybody should seriously engage in. And conservatives in this country are also reticent about that for the most part. But when you turn on cable news, it's like a, should we or should we not? Let's have a reasonable debate about an act of war against a nuclear power.
What's also missing from this conversation is the extraordinary measures that we are prepared to take as a country to help with Ukrainian refugees. I know that we're doing temporary protected status in this country, but we should be talking about airlifts and funding. And this is what we should be. I think you can listen for hours upon hours and hear no one even hinted something like that. It's pretty stunning in that regard. But war is much more entertaining.
Yes.
I mean, this is I don't know if I could say something less profound than if it bleeds, it leads. And this has been something since, back when we would read the newspaper and get ink on our hands. And even when we would get it from the Pony Express, maybe, I don't know about
right,
that.
Right. Well, when you would.
But yeah, exactly. But that's the situation that we're facing. And of course, there is, they're so desperate to look at a way to pressure the Biden administration, I think, in this instance, who I think have been doing a fairly good job,
yes,
frankly, of avoiding that type of pressure. But they're so desperate. Now it's that Putin, when he says he's going to, if we engage in a no-fly zone, he's going to put his nuclear weapons on high alert, that we didn't come back and go, well, if you bomb us, we'll bomb you, seems honestly like they need some time to fill.
And last thing too, I saw that Jon Stewart said something like, this is what cable news is made to do, and when they really step up when there's a wartime effort.
I'll bet.
Yeah. What are they stepping up to do, honestly? I mean, it was a really, I think, stupid statement by him. They are stepping up because they want more action for their coverage. And when foreign correspondents are in these things, there is always a push for action for the sake of action. And being reactive in a situation like this could not be, it's the worst tendency of all. It's a very deadly tendency. And cable news and media like this, they're invested in the perception of American might above all, and power and hegemony. And they're completely, I think, oblivious to, or don't care about, the consequences of it. And the consequence would be more death. So that's what we cannot engage in.
Fascinating notion to think about one quarter of this type of coverage, just a quarter of it, for what's going on in Afghanistan as people are starving, or in Yemen, where we're bombing, just as like a low hanging fruit, thought experiment. What would happen if we had one quarter of the reporting that's going on in Yemen, or in Afghanistan? But that's all it is. Thought experiment, won't happen. And, we're just left to sort of, hopefully, I don't know, maybe the Saudis get tired, and maybe somehow in Afghanistan food starts to grow. So a couple of sponsors of today's program before we get to Kimberly St. Julian Barnin. This come up, actually. I was getting like a wellness check from a doctor, just like a, you know, over the phone type of thing. What are you doing for hydration? Yeah, not drinking that much water. And then I was like, wait a second, that's not true. I drink like 2 quarts, like half gallon. I drink a gallon of water a day with liquid IV.
Nice.
During the show. I mean, you know, you see that.
So that's a plus. Yes.
Yes. I was like, it took me a second to realize that. And I guess maybe it is because it's also incredibly enjoyable.
It's tasty. You don't even know it's
watermelon, lemon, lime, strawberry, pina colada. It's my weakness. People know
acai.
That. I don't acai. Even know how to pronounce that.
Yeah.
Liquid IV contains 5 essential vitamins, B3, B5, B6, B12, and vitamin C. Liquid IV, you get 3 times the electrolytes of traditional sports drinks. And Liquid IV is made with premium ingredients. It is non-GMO. It is free from gluten and dairy and soy. They use the science of cellular transport technology, and it's what makes Liquid IV so effective. It's designed to enhance rapid absorption of water and other key ingredients into the bloodstream. Liquid IV is on a mission to change the world. The company has donated over 19 million servings globally. For me, it's a great way to stay hydrated, particularly if I've overindulged the night before. But frankly, I realize like it's become just a daily thing, at least in terms of like when I'm doing the show. And then once or twice over the weekend, I remember to do the same thing. And it is, it's healthy to keep yourself hydrated. I use it when I travel, but I realize it also powers me through these shows. And the matcha one also, speaking of a little bit of an energy boost. But for me, these days, I get stuck on the tangerine. I'm awful. I haven't had watermelon or pina colada. It's been tangerine and matcha. That's it. But I'll go back. I go back and forth. You can grab Liquid IV in bulk nationwide at Costco, or you can get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com. Use the code MajorityRep at checkout. That's 25% off anything when you use the promo code MajorityRep at liquidiv.com. Experience better hydration today. liquidiv.com, promo code majority rep. Also, when we talk about sort of a daily ritual, if you will, no pun intended, you want to know what you're putting in your body and you want to know why. Well, Ritual's clean, vegan-friendly multivitamin is formulated with high-quality nutrients in a bioavailable forms that your body can actually use. No sugars, no GMOs, no major allergens, no synthetic fillers, no artificial colorants. Plus, the fresh taste and delayed release capsule makes taking your vitamins easy. Ritual delivers high quality nutrients, including vitamin D3, in just 2 daily pills. I hope I'm not giving anything away, but I am on the over 50 multivitamin. And it's good. My vitamin D levels, I would get criticized by my doctor, but he would say like, you need to raise your vitamin D levels.
Tough love.
Yeah. What's wrong with you, Sam? Your vitamin D is so low.
You look like crap.
You look like crap. He's actually said that to me at different times, but, the vitamin D level, it's up. And, very good for your health and for preventing, it's associated at the very least with protection from certain cancers. And here's the bottom line. Multivitamins should contain key nutrients in your forms that your body can actually use. So Ritual is now available for women, men, and teens. Ritual multivitamins are scientifically developed to help support different life stages. And here's the best part. Because I have many times in my life tried to start taking vitamins or multivitamin or whatever. And when I finish the first bottle, I forget to get the next bottle. And then a couple of days later, I'm done.
Auto refill, baby.
Your multivitamins are delivered to your door every month with free shipping that you can start. You can snooze it. You can cancel your subscription at any time. If you don't love Ritual within your first month, they refund your first order. But this is aside from getting high quality vitamins, which is important, having them delivered to you on a regular basis so that you maintain your good habits, that for me anyways, has been the key. Get key nutrients without all the BS. Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/majority to start your Ritual today. And lastly, I don't know if you know this, but only 9% of plastic actually gets recycled.
What?
Yep. Doesn't matter how much we put in our recycling bin. At Grove Collaborative, they believe it's time to ditch single-use plastics for good. So by 2025, Grove will be 100% plastic-free. What is Grove? It is a one-stop shop, if you will, for laundry care to hand soaps and more. They carry hundreds of products aimed at replacing single-use plastics across every room of your home and your head-to-toe personal care routine. Grove Co.'s concentrated cleaners and refillable glass bottles are friendlier to the planet, twice as effective as the leading natural brands. So I am now basically plastic-free when it comes to my hand pumps. I have, or I should say, the single-use hand pumps. I've got containers of Grove soap, and I refill. I'm a total refill guy now. Over 2 million households already rely on Grove Co. for safe formulas and refillable packaging that never compromises on performance. These guys got me through the lockdown during the pandemic. They get me my scent-free dishwashing soap and hand soap. I got to say, the hand soap pumps, and they also have their own orange concentrate cleaner that I use in a spray bottle, and I am exclusively that now, too. Hmm. So I don't buy all the different plastic bottles of this stuff. I just refill it, and it's I like the stuff on top of the fact that I feel like I'm not contributing to all the plastic. Go to grove.com/majority today. Get a free gift worth up to $50 with your first order. Plus, shipping is fast and free. Get started right now. grove.com/majority. grove.com/majority. Also, a couple of announcements. On Thursday of this week, I'm going to be at the Bell House for the Bituation Room.
Whoa.
Francesca Fiorentini is coming into town and doing her show live. You can get tickets at bituationroom.com. It's going to be fun. I think it's like at 7 or 8 p.m. at the Bell House. And then after you see me there, you can see all of us in a couple of weeks
at the
Bell House.
Yeah.
You can't go anymore. Well, you can.
If you have your ticket.
If you have your ticket, it's sold out. But you can live stream it. And if you sign up for the AM Quickie today at amquickie.com, you get a massive discount on the live streaming. Over 50%. I know. People are like, this is why you're bad at business. Well, I don't care. Over 50%. Check it out. AMQuickie.com. Also, there's a link in the AMQuickie.com to an interview with Jack Crosby, one of our writers of, he hasn't been doing it for the past couple of weeks or so. Corey's been doing it because Jack has been in Ukraine, still there, trying to get out, did an interview with The Discourse, the blog that he's cooperative, he's part of. But you can find that link there. So coupon code, link to Jack's interview. Sign up for the AIM quickie. You will not be disappointed. We have over 6,000 readers a day now on the AIM quickie.
Whoa.
I mean, on any given day. So check it out. People are really enjoying that newsletter. And it is still fully free 5 days a week. It may change, but check it out now while you can. All right. We're going to just take a quick break. No? All right. We're just going to roll right into it. There's an interview that Emma and I did on Friday with Kimberly St. Julian Varnon, PhD student in history at the University of Pennsylvania. Here is that interview. We'll be back at the end.
We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us now is Kimberly St. Julian Varnon. She is a PhD student in history at the University of Pennsylvania. Kimberly, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Vigeland. And I was just saying before we started, I think a lot of people in media found you via Twitter, and you have a discipline that is, I think, fairly unique in terms of your perspective on Ukraine. And so tell us that. I want to get into the Ukrainian history. I know you lived in Ukraine for some time as part of your studies. But just give us a sense of what your disciplinary study is, and then we'll talk a little bit about Ukrainian history and circle back around to some of those issues.
Sure. So I am from rural Southeast Texas, and you can totally hear it in my voice. So I didn't know about Russia or Ukraine until I was an undergrad at Swarthmore, and I started studying Soviet history. And kind of since then, I've been obsessed with the region. And so what I do now, like my dissertation research, is on, it uses the experiences of Africans and African Americans in the Soviet Union, but also in Eastern Germany, to kind of explore how does race work? What is the form of race in countries that are, in terms of their socialist ideology, are officially race neutral and don't see race as a means of categorizing people? So that's where the heart of my research is. And within the Soviet Union, I focus on Russia and Ukraine. So like overnight, my research has suddenly become very important to these like national discourses we're seeing.
Okay, and we'll circle back around that, but give us a little bit of history of Ukrainian history, and let's go back to, you know, pre 1914 even, just so okay. We get a sense, because the claim by Putin is there's two sets of claims. One which I think has some validity, not necessarily in terms of his response. In fact, specifically not necessarily in terms of his response, which is around the question of NATO. We'll get to that in a moment. But this notion of Ukraine being not really existing, that it's actually just greater Russia. Just walk us back Ukrainian history, and maybe, or start in the late 1800s and maybe walk us forward, maybe.
Awesome. And yes, I have to unteach a lot of what Vladimir Putin has put into the air. So the basic way to understand Ukrainian history before the rise of the Soviet Union is to understand that Ukraine as a united country is very recent in Ukrainian history. So before 1917, before 1914, at the start of World War I, Ukraine is split between the Austro-Hungarian Empire in the west and the Russian Empire in the east. And before this, Ukraine was for a long time, Western Ukraine was part of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And it's a joke for us Eastern European historians about how, like, if you look at a map between 1700 and 1900, you see Poland disappear because Poland is split up three times by Russia, Prussia, and Austro-Hungarian Empire. So Western Ukraine does not have a significant history with the Russian Empire, but Eastern Ukraine does. So Eastern Ukraine, thinking about Kiev, further east of Kiev, has been an important part of the Russian Empire. It was the grain basket of the Russian Empire. It was the grain basket of the Soviet Union, but also a key part of Imperial Russian history as the Valuyev Circular, which was passed in the mid to late 19th century or 1800s. And this prevented the publication of anything in Ukrainian. It didn't allow for the teaching of Ukrainian in schools. And so it was really reinforcing this Russian nationalist idea, which was Orthodox Christianity and Russian language and culture.
Can I ask you, I mean, so you said Kyiv West, but do you mean Kyiv East in terms of?
Kyiv East, yes.
Okay,
East,
okay,
Kyiv,
I got a little bit confused. And
sorry. Just,
and we should say, but when we say the breadbasket of Russia, it is because there's a tremendous amount of very, very fertile land there that is great for farming. What about Odessa at that point? Where is Odessa? Because this is, there's two things, right, that I think, I guess, you know, when you're talking about the 1800s and prior to that, that are super important in terms of resources, the idea of good farmland and then the idea of like a port. And so where was Odessa in that?
Odessa is the jewel of the Russian Empire. I mean, it was a key part of Catherine the Great's expansion of the Russian Empire in the mid to late 1700s. It is the most important port city in Ukraine, and it was a huge port for the Russian Empire. And so control of the Black Sea was also a key part of why when you see Russian imperial expansion to the south, why Odessa and Mariupol and Kherson, those areas in the south along the Black Sea are so important. So Odessa is not only economically important, it's very culturally important to Russian imperial history, particularly Russian Jewish history. So you have some later writers and Soviet writers like Isaac Babel, who comes from Odessa. His Odessa tales are famous because he had this like the gangster Bin Yukrik. But Odessa is also one of the birthplaces of I forgot the word. So Orthodox Judaism is also, it blooms in Odessa. So Odessa is very culturally important to Jewish history in Ukraine and in Russia. So one of the things when you think about Eastern Ukraine, so Kyiv East, those are the connections you see to the Russian Empire. But a key part of this, besides the official repression of Ukrainian language, is that Odessa, Kyiv, Eastern Ukraine has always been multicultural and multilingual. And so when you have Putin saying Russian speakers in Ukraine are Russians, that's just him blatantly, you know, painting over the fact that this has always been a multilingual country. When I was living in Ukraine in 2013, I only spoke Russian at that point, and I got along just fine. I was in Kyiv, I was in Odessa, I spoke Russian. People spoke Russian to me. Sometimes they speak Russian and Ukrainian. It's like famous Ukrainians can do this in the East, but in the same sentence, they'll speak Ukrainian and Russian. They're not the same language. I'm learning Ukrainian now. They're not the same language. So that's kind of the history of the imperial pre-1914 part of Eastern Ukraine. Western Ukraine is part of Austria-Hungary. They didn't have the same problems of the repression of Ukrainian nationalism. They were able to speak Ukrainian, write in Ukrainian. They also have a very unique religious mix in terms of the Uniate Church. And so you have an Eastern Orthodox Church that follows the Eastern Orthodox rites, but it follows the rulings in the leadership of the Pope. And that's a very unique mixture in Ukraine because of this connection between Orthodoxy, but in the Catholic Austro-Hungarian Empire. So before 1939, really, you don't see the united Ukraine we have now. You don't really see that until 1939, because the Western part for the longest time was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Then after all, the Austro-Hungarian Empire falls after World War I, it becomes part of Poland. So the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact is key to this story, because in this pact, you have the Soviets agreeing with the Nazis to invade Poland. And that's when we see that part of Western Ukraine becoming joined to the East, is because of the Soviet invasion in 1939.
Oh, interesting. I didn't realize that. And so then it becomes part of the then Soviet Union at that point. And as it becomes part of the Soviet Union, it's not a chartered country at that point, right? It becomes more a region of the Soviet Union, or is it, how did that work?
So this is special. The Soviet Union is officially established in 1922. And one of the reasons why you have this ethno-federal state is because of Ukraine. So the Soviets knew that they couldn't really have a powerful economy without the breadbasket, the Black Earth region of Ukraine. So the only way they could get this to work is to promote Ukrainian nationalism. So that's why you have the creation of the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. And so the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic, I can't say USSR because then it'll get even more confusing. It is part of the Soviet Union, and it's probably the second most powerful of the Soviet Socialist Republics, Russia being the most powerful. So when the West is conjoined to the East, it becomes part of the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. And so that's really the first time we see West and East Ukraine that we see today fully connected. But Crimea is not part of this yet. It's not part of Ukraine until 1954.
Okay. And at what point does Stalin come in and says, you have a breadbasket, you have a lot of farmers, you have farmers who tend to, at least in my experience, still in this country, very much in rural areas, you get a different relationship to the land, and the idea of collectivizing land becomes a little bit problematic. Stalin doesn't want that. What does Stalin do when?
This is a great question. It's also the topic of my master's thesis.
I've asked the right person then.
So the first five-year plan begins in 1928. So you have two parts. You have the forced collectivization of agriculture, which is Stalin's view necessary to get as much grain exports as possible to fund vast and very quick industrialization. So these two pieces go hand in hand in Stalin's five-year plan. The problem is, collectivization is hugely unpopular. I mean, it's particularly in Ukraine and the Black Earth region. So what happens is you have the initial push into the Ukrainian countryside by the Bolsheviks. They have this thing called the 25,000ers. So there are a lot of young Komsomol volunteers who go to the countryside to try to create collectivized farms. And unsurprisingly, they're not very successful. And one of my favorite things about my thesis work and research is reading the peasants and how they're reacting. They're like beating up these guys. They're like stealing their stuff and they're yelling at them. So like you see the video now of like the Ukrainian woman shaming the Russian soldier, like put these sunflower seeds in your pocket. That goes all the way back. We have, you know, similar stories of them realizing the Bolsheviks don't know anything about agriculture.
Today would be if you go into a rural area coming from a city, you're referred to as a cityit. And there's that quality. Right. Okay. So this is.
Yes.
Yes.
And so the response is by the Soviet government, well, if they're not going to join on their own, we'll make them join. And so one of the key things here is, I think, so when we think about the Holodomor, which is what it's called in Ukrainian, death by hunger, the famine that ensues in 1932-33 is a state-made famine. The Bolsheviks send in Komsomol activists. And so what they do is they take so much grain, there is no food left. And millions of people starve to death. And so this happens in eastern Ukraine particularly, but throughout Ukraine, as famine happens, it happens in the southern region of Russia near the Don Basin, but also it happens in Kazakhstan. So you have this process, and it looks different across these three regions. But in Ukraine, not only was it the collectivization of agriculture, peasants were some of the most staunch Ukrainian nationalists, because many of them remember when they were part of the Russian Empire and they couldn't speak their language. They weren't taught in their language. So they want to maintain Ukrainian culture and use Ukrainian language. So they see the Soviet forces through collectivization as yet another imposition upon them. And so millions of people die. And what I argue in my thesis is that this was part of the subjectivizing process. This is how Stalin turned the Ukrainian countryside into Soviet subjects. Because after 1933, once the famine dissipates and they start releasing more grain to the peasantry, you don't see huge uprisings in the countryside again. Before that, there were tons of uprisings, lots of violence towards Bolshevik activists in the collective farms. But after this, the majority of the farms are collectivized, and you don't really see that uproar in the countryside again.
What? I mean, what is that? Just simply like people? Is that a function of people have taken a beating, and or that when you have that level of conflict, the people who are most inclined to revolt are killed, imprisoned, weeded out, essentially? Is it that the deaths of those people just simply dissipates their collective power to respond in that instance? I mean, what are the factors that change the disposition? I mean, to subjectivize them, as you say.
I think it's a mixture of all the points you've made. And so what you see, and it's really heartbreaking. So in my thesis, I look at peasantry. I look at people who were part of the intelligentsia before the Russian Revolution in 1917. And I look at communist activists. And so the peasants, they learn that if they continue to fight, they're going to keep starving. So in a way, they just accept that collectivization is happening. But also, they lose so many people. They literally do not have the strength to fight. The intelligentsia is interesting because the people I've studied, their diaries, they have this crisis of faith. They have this crisis, this existential crisis of what does it mean to be a person who still has food, but to watch everyone around you starve to death. And so a lot of them, like, they become depressed. Some of them turn to suicide because there's no way for them to, like, you know, reconcile the position that they're in. But the communist activists tend to go in two groups. One, either they become gung-ho, you know, communists, and they are, that the birth by fire has forged them as, you know, complete Stalinist supporters. Or the other half, and so many of them, they end up turning away, or they continue to be part of the Communist Party because that's the only way to get ahead. But many of them are victims of the purges in 1936, 1937. So they're imprisoned, they're sent to Siberia, they're killed. So I think it is a combination of things. But what I argue for the peasantry is that the famine broke the key means of survival in the countryside, which is, you know, reciprocity and subsistence. And because their subsistence was taken away from them, the role of reciprocity in the village commune was destroyed. So, like, irreparable harm was done to the interpersonal connections. And so when that happens, you can't depend on your neighbor, so you must depend on the state, if that makes sense.
It does. And how much of that era remains in the public consciousness today or a week ago, 10, or, you know, mm-hmm. when you were there?
It's huge. Mostly because this is something people weren't able to talk about until the collapse of the Soviet Union. So 1991, you have, you know, the creation of the independent Ukrainian state, but it's only been about the last 12, 15 years that the Holodomor has become part of the Ukrainian national consciousness. It's been added to textbooks. We have a Holodomor memorial. And so for the first time, like when I was there in 2013, I was talking to people about my research and I said, my grandmother remembers that. My grandpa remembers that. My parents remember that. And it was the first time their parents and grandparents had talked about these experiences. There's a lot of shame for people who survived because there's also widespread reports of cannibalism. So, like, it's a very complicated process for Ukrainians to go through. And what I have seen, like, I read Ukrainian, I, you know, speak and read Russian. I'm learning how to speak Ukrainian. Now we're seeing more instances of, look at what they did to us in 1932, 33. Because of the images we're seeing in Ukraine now, where cities that are encircled are starting to run out of food. So this is very much part of the national memory, and they're bringing it up right now, for sure, on the ground in Ukraine.
That's fascinating. I mean, it's almost like, you know, their version of the Dunning School, I guess, on some level, or, you know, a slightly different dynamic now, but there seems to be a reawakened awareness of it and poorly timed, at least relative to what I think the expectations were of Putin. So let's move up to the fall of the Soviet Union. Ukraine becomes independent. It retains both East and West, and it's, mm-hmm. it also has a sizable amount. Like you say, it was the second most powerful member, essentially, of the Soviet Union. Also has a sizable amount of nuclear weapons that they have control over. I don't think people mm-hmm. understood this, that, like, the weapons sort of became the property of where they were stationed. And so what is, this is where we start getting into the other part that is ostensibly part of Putin's motivation, of which I am not as skeptical as a lot of people, I think. I don't think it explains the majority of the story, frankly. I think there's a certain amount of convenience that it exists, but it's not like there weren't people in the United States in the mid-90s in our Senate. Guys like Sam Nunn, Daniel Moynihan, these are not necessarily, you know, doves who are saying we should not be expanding NATO, never mind Ukraine. We should not be expanding it. There were some who were saying, like, you know, we're done with it. It served its purpose. But there was a deal with Ukraine by the West. Talk about that.
Yes, the 1994 Budapest Memorandums. So what Ukraine did was, in exchange for promises of the recognition of its territorial sovereignty by the United States, the United Kingdom, and Russia, Ukraine gave up its entire nuclear arsenal. And so that promise was actually held until about 2013, and when we saw the Russian reaction to the Euromaidan protests. And what has been interesting is, I know I have Ukrainian friends who are saying that was a mistake.
Is there another example of that? I mean, there may have been other former Soviet republics, but I mean, we've seen this dynamic with, you know, Iran and North Korea, and I think it was maybe Libya stopped its pursuit of nuclear weapons, I think, at one point. And, you know, this is a bad lesson to be teaching.
It is. It's a dangerous lesson because, I mean, I believe President Zelensky said it last week. He was like, well, if the Budapest Memorandum isn't going to be upheld, you're not going to uphold your end. Why should we uphold ours?
It reminds me a little of what we're seeing with the Iran deal in the United States. Although, yeah. I mean, like, why would we disarm ourselves if you're just going to break the promise right afterwards?
And I think this is kind of something that hasn't been mentioned a lot, is everyone's watching what's happening in Ukraine and the lessons that are being imparted, not only to Western countries, but countries who are considered second tier powers, but who are considering nuclear development. This is a very important lesson for them to learn. But also, like, Ukraine still has nuclear power, as we saw yesterday. The Zaporozhye nuclear power station was shelled. Chernobyl is controlled by the Russian military. So I think the nuclear question, both power, nuclear power, as France is pursuing nuclear power through the EU, but also nuclear weapons, these two questions are being settled right now in Ukraine on the ground.
So the Budapest memos signed by the U.S., Russia, and the EU at that point, or no, the
United Kingdom.
United Kingdom. And so there's at least one of our, I think, sort of broken promises. There was also, my understanding too, simultaneously at that time, was I think it was Gorbachev. I don't know if there was an explicit signed document, but there was also a sense that NATO would not be expanded as part of the dissolution of the Soviet Union. What can you tell us about that?
So the agreement, so the question, this is one of, like, the mysterious parts of studying the end of the Soviet Union. So Yeltsin gets a verbal confirmation from, I can't remember the American diplomat's name, but this is actually about East Germany. So after Germany right. reunited, it was the question of expanding NATO and allowing all of Germany, united Germany, into NATO. And so NATO is an important question, but I think what's interesting now is we're seeing the limits of NATO in the current Russian invasion of Ukraine. But also, Ukraine hasn't really pursued NATO, like joining NATO. It wasn't actually popular in Ukraine. It has never been more popular in the past 2 weeks, you know. So that's the problem. But yeah, Ukrainian public opinion has actually been split on NATO for years. But it was after Euromaidan, in which Ukraine decided, and I believe they've added to the constitution, that they would pursue joining NATO. It was after the Russian incursion in 2013. I argue, like, the EU is much more important to Ukraine and has been. So if you remember the news in 2013, I came back from Ukraine a couple of months before the Euromaidan protests started. And so the Euromaidan protest started because President Yanukovych, he did not sign the EU association agreement. And the idea, the thinking was, this is because Putin, he was, you know, pro-Russian, very aligned with Putin, that Putin had pretty much told him not to. So you start seeing popular protests springing up all around Ukraine, particularly in Maidan Nezalezhnosti or the Independence Square. And so these protests happen, but Yanukovych uses the special forces and they kill 100 civilians. These are called the Heavenly 100. And every year they celebrate, you know, these 100 civilians who were killed by the special forces. So the protests get more, they get bigger, they spread across more of Ukraine. And Yanukovych ends up fleeing to Russia. And I think he spent some time in Belarus. So you have the new, you know, Ukrainian government that's elected, that's put together. And so this is when...
I'm sorry, can I just stop you there? In terms of the protests, how were they dispersed east-west?
So a lot in the west, also really strong in the east. Like Kyiv is in the middle, but Kharkiv, Odessa, they're spread throughout. They spread throughout Ukraine, but they're very heavy in western Ukraine. Which makes sense because Western Ukraine has very strong ties to Poland, which is also, you know, trying to join the EU. So when you have a new Ukrainian government that's formed, they held elections, and this is when interesting things start happening. Interesting if you are a historian and you're a nerd. Not interesting if you have to live through these, these right. situations. So two things happen. Luhansk and Donetsk. So in Russian, there's a word in Ukrainian, it's called oblast. So if you think about an oblast, it's like a super region. So you have Luhansk and Donetsk oblasts, and within Luhansk and Donetsk, you have smaller sections like counties also called Luhansk and Donetsk, which is why sometimes Russian Ukrainian just makes more sense. So these two regions, these two counties in these regions, Luhansk and Donetsk, they are called breakaway regions or occupied regions, depending on where you are. So you have pro-Russian forces there were armed by Russia, and they start fighting against Ukrainian forces. So these two places are disputed. But within these two places, you also have thousands of Ukrainians who live and work and are just trying to exist within that. Those become the basis for the war that we see, you know, right now. But also you have the annexation of Crimea. So in 2014, you have a memorandum, which was totally unfair, besides the fact that election officials weren't even able to watch, they were nowhere near where the elections was happening. The boxes were clear. They were outside and you had little green men because they weren't recognized themselves as Russian, but everyone knew they were Russian military pointing guns at you as you voted. So Crimea is forcibly annexed by Ukraine. This is illegal, but it still happens. And what's wild is overnight, once Crimea is forcibly annexed and recognized by Russia, the laws change. And a key part of this story is what happens to the minority population, the Crimean Tatars, who are the indigenous population of Crimea. They have experienced absolute hell from the Soviet period onward. They were forcibly deported by the Stalinist government. Many of them were sent to Central Asia. Many of them died. And once the Soviet Union collapses, they're able to come back to Crimea. And so since then, since the Russian takeover in 2014, their community leaders have been oppressed. They've been thrown into prison. Their religious practices have been repressed by the Russian government, and many of them have had to leave and go into exile. Many of them in mainland Ukraine, but also many in Canada. So these processes that we're seeing now, I will fundamentally argue, are because of what happened in 2013 and 2014.
Well, and so in terms of like the pro-Russian sentiment in Crimea, like, do you think that that's overblown in terms of, because you're basically saying that there are indigenous populations in Crimea that are being silenced in terms of like the sentiment when we're looking at, a postmortem of what happened in 2013 and 2014.
Absolutely. And so there are pro-Russian, pro-Putin forces in like Luhansk and Donetsk and Crimea. But so the problem is with Crimea, the Russian population in Crimea is a result of the deportation of Crimean Tatars. It's another form of like new settler colonization. You get rid of the Crimean Tatars, this land and all these homes open up. So a lot of Russian Soviet citizens moved into Crimea. Because Crimea has always been a popular vacation spot, even in the Imperial Russian period. So if, like, you got tuberculosis, you would go to Crimea to get the warm weather and to help your lungs check off. So what happens is, so these pro-Russian forces, they are there and they do exist. And that's definitely an important part of the dynamics you see in Crimea now, but also Luhansk and Donetsk. But Luhansk and Donetsk, this has been a hot war for 8 years there, right? So, I think the media and the way things are being portrayed in Ukraine right now is very interesting to me, because I'm like, y'all have not cared for 8 years.
I want to get into that change. And, and we've had 14,000 people die over the course of those 8 years. Who were those people that died? And how? And then I want to get into this change that has taken place, where, I mean, I remember when Russia annexed Crimea. I remember when the separatists took over. I remember the protest, and there was, you know, it was mostly like, frankly, neocons who were, you know, people like John McCain who were, you know, talking about it. But there was just very little reporting, very little. There was no images. It was, you know, I personally was fairly ignorant as to where Ukraine was. I don't think I was aware. Like, you don't call it the Ukraine anymore. I mean, all of that. But but first, talk about the 14,000 people who have died in those 8 years in this hot war. Who's been fighting? How have those people died? And then let's talk about this change, which, you know, I think I mentioned beforehand was, how I the first tweet I saw was of yours was talking about that change in why all of a sudden Europe was opening their doors, and the world was, you know, very quickly, you know, becoming in solidarity with Ukrainians.
Those really great, really great questions. And I'm so glad you asked about the 14,000 people have died in Eastern Ukraine. So it's a mixture. You have Ukrainian army who have died in combat against the pro-Russian separatists. You have a lot of civilians who've died. I mean, crossfire, shelling. They still use artillery in Luhansk and Donetsk. They've dropped artillery on civilian places. So you have civilian
deaths. The separatists have dropped, or the Ukrainian
the separatists.
Army?
Yeah, the separatists. So you have the Ukrainian army and the separatists using weapons and artillery against
each
other.
They're both hitting civilians.
Yeah. And so, like, people are dying. And so when people talk about the Russo-Ukrainian war, I'm like, of 2022, because this has been happening for so long. But also, and Secretary Blinken tweeted about this today, but, like, everyone who works on Ukraine, who speaks Russian or Ukrainian, we've known there are torture camps in Luhansk and Donetsk. I mean, if you are a Ukrainian and you're captured by the Luhansk and Donetsk separatists, the story, like, electrocution, waterboarding, they are torturing people. Especially if they catch Ukrainian civilians who are helping the Ukrainian military. And so they're also part of this large number of people who've died. So Khromadsky.ua, it's a Ukrainian language news site, but also they do lifestyle reporting. They cover a lot of information. They're also available in English, but their Ukrainian coverage, they've been interviewing people who have survived, you know, these torture camps, who've been able to get out. So it's a mixture of kind of the worst elements of war is what we've seen in the past 8 years. But all, like, these people, there are civilians, and also I would argue, like, I don't know the specific number, but also Ukrainian military have been dying.
And what's your sense of both Russian money flowing in terms of separatists, and maybe Western money in terms of, like, the opposition? Like, there, you know, there are a lot of ghouls here in the United States that are trying to look at, like, how can we make Ukraine a proxy battle to weaken Putin? I mean, we covered this a little bit earlier in the show, and I'm concerned about that. But, like, on a micro level, has that been going on for a little while?
So we know for sure most of the artillery, the guns, the weapons are coming from Russia. But that's the benefit of being pro-Russian, because they should not have access to these types of things from the Ukrainian side. But also, like, after you kill off a Ukrainian battalion, take their stuff. And that's kind of, you know, the rules of the game in the East. I don't know about like foreign involvement in the war, but also it's one of those things like I have no idea, like MI6, CIA, you know, so, you know, you would never know. But I do know when we look at what's happening now and the way it was started by Russia recognizing Luhansk and Donetsk as independent, I expected that to happen in 2014. So it that wasn't new to me. But I am interested in the end game here. And like, because everyone's talking about, will Putin have an off-ramp and, you know, things like that. But just from what I've seen, and like I'm in contact with the people on the ground and stuff like that, the Luhansk, Donetsk, Kharkiv, they're being flattened. So even if this does become like a Russian occupied area, there's not much left to occupy, if that makes sense.
It's also, I mean, you know, this is, you know, like I think we have limited value, I think, in jumping ahead and imagining where things are going, because I don't, you know, but it seems also it's going to be a very difficult territory to occupy. I don't think that like this is not going to be, there's going to be a lot of overextension by Russians and a lot of anger on the part of Ukrainians that I don't think is going to easily dissipate. But I don't know. But let's turn to this to the differences between 2014 and 2022 relative to the way that the rest of the world envisions Ukraine, because I think you made this point, and it's also I think indicative of like your studies of race in the context of Europe, particularly in Ukraine. I saw you tweet about the idea of race in Poland, and you specifically wouldn't address that because it wasn't part of your expertise, which I appreciated because it's pretty hard to find people who do that. It speaks to the social construction of race, of status in some fashion. So let's talk about that. But I also, I want to, and I guess at one point too, I want to talk about the idea of neo-Nazis in Ukraine, the ideas of the Azov, regiment. And let me also just preface this too, because this gets into very sensitive stuff where people feel like you're doing Putin's job by, saying that there is a neo-Nazi element in Ukraine. I we're not doing Putin's job here. We're discussing certain realities. There's also, incidentally, there was a neo-Nazi, as far as I was concerned, pretty close, maybe not quite. A version of CPAC just a couple of days ago in Orlando. So it's not like that develops the whole country. But all right. So I'm sorry, I asked about four questions there. But taking from there, in terms of like what has changed in terms of the way that we look at Ukrainians, by we I mean non-Ukrainians,
right? And like as I tweeted, I said this is really new, where everyone's opening their arms to Ukrainians and saying, they're just like us. They're blonde haired, you know, and blue eyed, which if you've been to Ukraine, you know, that's not true. but it shows this projection of whiteness and sameness onto Ukrainians that we didn't see in 2013. We didn't see in 2014. And honestly, we hadn't really seen until Russia literally put tanks into Ukraine. So Ukraine has always been multilingual and multi-ethnic. It has a large Roma population. It has large, as we've seen, African, Middle Eastern population. But Ukraine, as many as other Eastern European countries and Southern European countries, and we think about the hierarchy of race in Western Europe, they've always been at the bottom. You see, and even in like, you know, popular culture, references to how, you know, Russians are treated or how Ukrainians, they're always gangsters, right? Or they're always, I'm trying to, like gwopniks, like they have tracksuits and they're a punchline. Or they are cleaners, or they're paid low-wage jobs. And so what's interesting in Western Europe is that, and I would argue that this new embracing of Ukraine, one, comes from realizing just how little they did in 2014 to, you know, stave off what's happening right now. But also, it helps you keep Ukrainians in Eastern Europe, though. So we have Poland opening the borders. Hungary is opening its borders. What about Germany? What about France? What about the UK? You know, like, so you still have this underlying thing where we don't want all of those people coming in. But I think the key thing that has changed is the Russian onslaught. And I was in a panel earlier, and this professor made an excellent point. She said, instead of thinking about, you know, how everyone is welcoming Ukraine, think about what Ukraine had to go through to be welcomed into whiteness. And I think that is a powerful way to frame what we're seeing in Ukraine, because at the end of the day, Ukraine is still fighting this war alone. And I think that shows the limits to this narrative of they're just like us. But even in, I think it was one of the major Western journalists, talking heads on the ground, he said, they're relatively civilized.
Oh, yes. We've seen a lot of these examples.
Yeah. And I'm like, that
unlike Iraq, unlike Iraq, unlike Afghanistan, right?
Exactly.
So,
but they're still relatively civilized, right? Yeah. So I think that word relatively, they're telling on themselves. But also we saw the Bulgarian prime minister saying, these aren't the refugees we're used to. They're educated. But it's because Ukraine's also in Eastern Europe. So yeah, Ukraine is very much closer to Bulgaria. But overall, what we're seeing here is the framework of this white supremacist understanding of hierarchy that we see in Western Europe. And it's showing itself through these media, you know, representations of Ukraine. But most importantly, with what we're seeing at the borders with Africans and Middle Eastern students and Indian students and Roma citizens of Ukraine trying to get into Poland. And so this conflict is putting on display for the world things that people who look like me, who live and work in Eastern Europe, have always known. So it's been interesting. But let's talk about Azov.
Well, I want to stay on this point just for one moment, and then we'll get to Azov, because this is almost like a real-time version of that book, How the Irish Became White, type of situation. But you make the point that in this instance, we can also see a real-time limitations on that, both in terms of how much people want to absorb Ukrainians, period, but also the Afro-Ukrainian population that is in the Ukraine, or in Ukraine, I should say, and how it's like there has been at least a dynamic of this may be slight bridge too far on some level just expand on that a little bit, because I know that you've been in touch obviously with students there and with both Africans who are in Ukraine maybe studying or whatnot, or descendants of in many respects of students.
Mm-hmm. So, which is funny because like people said, I made up the Afro-Ukrainian community. And I'm like, that's cool. I literally discovered Afro-Ukrainians because I ran into a couple of them in the street in Kyiv. And I was like, you exist? So yes, there is an Afro-Ukrainian population. Many of them are descendants of African students who studied in the Soviet Union and Ukraine and settled down and had families. The most famous is Jean Vilenuk. He's a member of the Ukrainian parliament, but also he is a gold medal Greco-Roman wrestler. He won gold for Ukraine in the Summer Olympics. And so this population exists. And when you see some of these horror stories of racism at the border, this is important because these are Ukrainians and their Slavicness, their Ukrainianness is being denied to them because of their Africanness. And you're seeing this play out in real time. And what's been so fascinating to me, I mean, even the EU, we're singing, you know, Kumbaya and everyone welcome to our borders. But the EU declaration for refugees from Ukraine yesterday does not include third country nationals. All of these foreign students who are having to flee, they don't get free passage. If you're an asylum seeker from Syria or Afghanistan, many of whom live in Ukraine, you don't get free passage into the EU.
Despite the fact that they're in Ukraine getting bombed. I mean, so it really is, I would imagine, and hopefully this conflict ends, you know, before we air this interview, frankly, but this is going to be, you know, a fascinating opportunity to see how these constructions work. And I should say that, like, you know, the civilized thing, I, you know, I have seen deployed in the context of Israel welcoming Ethiopian and second order Ethiopian Jews making trying to make Aliyah to Israel, where mm-hmm. the absorption of Ethiopians is more difficult with people who may have been living in the countryside, may have not seen running water, may not have, you know, are used to sort of the way that Western countries or, you know, European styled countries function and are organized. So there may be some costs associated, but that's often a way of like, I mean, the that's a way of, I think, sort of hiding the ball a little bit. And
for sure.
See it in this context, very clearly. All right. So speak about the Azov regiment and this idea of neo-Nazis. Certainly there were Ukrainians who were aligned with the Nazis during World War II, but mm-hmm. talk about those and then get into the neo-Nazis as well.
This is an excellent point, and I think that some people want to run away from this history, but we can't. And so, particularly in Western Ukraine, during World War II, you had nationalist groups like the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalism, OUN. And so what they did was they collaborated with the Nazis. So they were fighting against the Soviets and collaborating with the Nazis. So that's one element of this, is that Western Ukraine is invaded by the Soviet Union. So when the Nazis invade the Soviet Union in 1941, they join, right? The enemy is my enemy is my friend. That's one layer. The second layer is the anti-Semitism and the hatred of Jews. That's another thing that bonded these partisan groups to, and of course not all partisan groups, but like the OUN with the Nazis. And this is important because, Tim Snyder, his book Bloodlands, it's like a good introduction for this for like lay readers. When we think about the Holocaust, so many people think of Auschwitz, Birkenau, they think of the camps. But the overwhelming majority of the Eastern European Jews were in Belarus, in Ukraine, and Poland. This goes back to the Russian Empire, because that was the only place they could settle, is in that strip of land called the Pale Love Settlement. So millions of Jews were killed in Ukraine. The Ukrainian Jewish population was decimated. So was that of Belarus. So this plays a key part in this history of Ukraine. So you have this you know, partisan part, and Bandera, who's probably the most famous of all the partisans, he goes into exile and he never renounces what he did when he was collaborating with the Nazis. And so when we move to now, Azov Battalion, and someone asked me, well, was the Azov Battalion, were you afraid of them when you were in Ukraine? I'm like, they didn't exist when I was in Ukraine. Azov Battalion is a direct growth of 2014, Luhansk and Donetsk and the fighting there. So the Azov Battalion is a far right neo-Nazi group, and they, you know, arm themselves to fight in Eastern Ukraine against these far Russian, you know, Russian forces. So they're hyper-nationalistic, and they're also anti-Semitic, and they're also racist. Let me just say, like, the fact that neo-Nazis exist in Ukraine and in Russia will never not make me angry as a Soviet historian who knows about World War II. Like, it's ridiculous, but that's for another day. So that's a battalion. They became popular because they were fighting against these, you know, these far right, I mean, the pro-Russian forces. But in the past 5 years, something interesting has happened with Azov. So they've grown more marginalized within greater Ukrainian society. But the Azov Battalion itself has been absorbed into the Ukrainian National Guard. And that's how they were continuing to fight in the east in Luhansk and Donetsk. One of their most famous members, I forget his name, but he was voted into the Ukrainian parliament. I think a few more of their members they've made the professionalization where you go from wearing your neo-Nazi fatigues to wearing a suit. And then you know, that part. So I think Azov and members of Azov, who they've kind of expanded from just focusing on fighting into trying to create a national political party, they got less than 3% of the vote, I think. It's less than 5 or less than 3% of the vote in the latest parliamentary elections. So that's to put that on the table, because it's important and we have to recognize it. I lived in Ukraine. I had a run-in with skinheads, like, These are very, you know, real things. And I think this is important because if we hide this history, it does nothing but support Putin's idea of what Ukraine is. When he says he's going to denazify the country, when he calls, you know, the entire Ukrainian government fascist or neo-Nazi, if you don't talk about these important aspects of Ukrainian culture and history, then when people find it, it's like, oh, we've been hiding that. You don't want us to know that. And admittedly, I think a lot of people, it's like Ukrainian members of parliament and government, they don't want to focus on that because they think it will draw away from support for Ukraine. And I understand where they're coming from, but I think you have to address this full on, because then you can see and talk about. So when Putin says he's denazifying a country, he's focusing on Azov Battalion and some of the far right groups in Ukraine to generalize for the entire country, including a country led by a Jewish president and a Jewish prime minister. So these are like the important things. And I think we shouldn't hide it. But and this isn't whataboutism, but it's also Putin is projecting, because you want to talk about the granddaddy of far right and neo-Nazi groups, Russia. And so, yeah, Russia has similar problem. I mean, and as you said earlier, this is a problem of the far right across Eastern Europe, Hungary, Poland, Slovakia, Russia, Ukraine. None of these countries is exempt from this particular development.
And again, Steve Scalise, I think at one point is reported to have said at one point, I'm David Duke without the baggage, when he was running for his position back in the day. So which is not in any way, obviously, to diminish the presence of these. But there, it's not a defining element of Ukraine. Well, Kimberly, I can't thank you enough. I feel like this has been an amazing assessment of history and get a sense of where we are, and hopefully you know, maybe we can touch base again to talk more about some of these issues as hopefully, God willing, things calm down. It's hard. Here we're recording this on Friday. We'll play this probably on Monday to get a sense of where the step down is. Do you have any ideas on that? I mean, maybe in closing, I mean, I know that is sort of like outside of maybe of your portfolio, but having had experience in Ukraine and someone who has been sensitive to these issues over the course, because I think there was a lot of people who felt like plan A was maybe just thought they'd be greeted with flowers and candy, and we get rid of Zelensky. Maybe we have to kill him. And because there's reportedly been multiple hit squads been sent to kill him, you know, the validity of which, you know, it's very difficult in the context of war to know how true these things are. But largely people thought the idea was replace the government. Ukrainians will be more or less okay with that. And, you know, then we don't even have to have much of a military presence. Probably after a couple of months, we go back, everything's back to normal. It's like Crimea. And, you know, occasionally somebody says there's a problem, but that's it. That's clearly not happening. What are the other options?
So I think the killing Zelensky and replacing him is still on the table. And they've been floating, like if you watch the Russian news, Yanukovych. Yeah, you know, he's back into vogue. But I think a key thing is we have to watch what happens over the next few days. If Ukraine is continuing to fight this alone, Ukraine can't defeat Russia by contemporary and normal military means. It just doesn't have the resources. So the Russian news has shown multiple times of what a rump state Ukraine would look like. So think about the North Korea-South Korea solution. It seems like that is in the Kremlin's interests. It's kind of carving up Ukraine, having Eastern Ukraine not be part of Russia, but having a government that will essentially be a puppet state for Russia. And I think that's a key thing here. That's why we've seen whenever they're going to have peace talks, you have the nuclear deterrence forces called up. Or before we have peace talks, we're going to, you know, shell Zaporizhia nuclear power station. So I think those are key developments to kind of watch, because we're beginning to see this. But I don't hold any hope in Putin's peace talks, but also understanding Putin as a person who believes in realpolitik And people like to say, oh, he's a KGB agent and oh, he doesn't have a soul and blah, blah, blah. None of that's useful. What he is an astute politician who understands hard power, boots on the ground. And he learned this from Yalta, from World War II, wherever the Soviet tanks were, wherever the Soviet men were, that was in your sphere of influence. That is still very much the case. And I think what Putin is showing also is the limits of these Western institutions. And also, they can't save you. And I think that's a key lesson that he's imparting to the former Soviet states. But I don't know how we get out of this. I think it's up to Vladimir Putin to decide how this ends.
Kimberly St. Julian Varnin, really appreciate your time today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Kimberly. Really fascinating stuff. Really appreciate it.
Really appreciate
it. Thank you.
We are back, Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. That was a little rusty. I hadn't talked for an hour. And so,
Sam Cedar.
There we go, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you enjoyed that interview. I should read some feedback that we did get on the interview. This IM came during the interview from not Sam's ex-wife. I understand that this is a pre-recorded interview from Friday, but Sam looks entirely too casual for a Monday. His commitment issues are on full display for all to see. Is it too much to ask for Sam to change his shirt to a stiff, freshly pressed button-down for the interview? Christ, no one is asking him to wear a tie. That is from not Sam's ex-wife on the IM. Appreciate the feedback, of course, at all times.
Always.
To any interview. Going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. Just a couple of reminders for you. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. You get 10% off Just Coffee. I don't know what else to tell you. You can get the Majority Report blend there, too.
Oh, yeah.
Check that out.
Great coffee.
Also, don't forget our live shows, majoritylive.com. You can go and buy a streaming ticket for our show in Brooklyn. If you sign up at amquickie.com first, you can see the coupon code. There's a link in that AM Quickie newsletter that you'll get tomorrow, and you will save over 50% on a live streaming show. Yes, it's actually possible. People ask, how is that possible? We didn't realize the coupon codes could go that high because no one has ever offered more than 50% off a streaming thing.
It's a world record.
Apparently, people didn't even know that it was physically possible
to
do that.
Many people are saying.
And so you can sign up at amquickie.com and get that. And of course, we still have tickets for the Boston show. And I'm telling you, the Boston show is a show that you're going to like walk away from and say, I can't believe I was lucky enough to go to that.
Life changing.
Well, let's not get carried away, but the bar is pretty low for things that people are lucky to do.
Well, the bar is anything can change your life. It'll change your life. I mean, anything can be life changing.
That's true.
Right.
Yes.
Just because you've gone to something, it did in some way alter your life.
It's true. I could have been sitting at home doing nothing today, but instead my life changed and right. I went and saw this show.
That's so, the definition I was operating.
All right. Under. Well, then, yes, I would say that times two almost. Folks, 646-257-3920. See